Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places with your host, Adam Bronstein.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. I know it's been quite a while since I've published a new episode, so I'm very excited to be back in front of the mic. I've been very busy with my conservation work and wilderness advocacy. And this project really does take up quite a bit of time, or at least it has in the past. So now I've dropped the maintenance of the website. I'll just have the episodes posted there. I've also discontinued all of my social media channels. So you can expect episodes kind of in a random order. They'll be on an ad hoc basis. And if there's a topic that I'd like to cover, I will cover it and publish. But please expect sporadic episodes going forward. It's been great that folks have still been listening to and enjoying the past episodes, and the listenership continues to grow. So stay subscribed here and catch new episodes as I release them and as I have time. In this episode, I speak with Eric Molvar, Executive Director with Western Watersheds Project. We discuss his guidebook writing, the state of our public land system, the work of Western Watersheds Project, the influence of domestic livestock on wilderness and public lands, attitudes and historical context of wilderness, Native American omission from the Wilderness Act, the relevancy and importance of wilderness designation, how to manage public lands for the benefit of ecosystems and the human, collaborative conservation, and challenging the dominant culture of colonialism and dominion over nature. You can learn more about Western Watersheds at westernwatersheds.org. And thanks for listening. I bring you Eric Molvar. I haven't done a podcast in quite a while, so this is exciting to be back on with you, Eric. And I have a few others lined up. Kind of exactly how I envision the podcast going forward is just doing it on an ad needed basis. And I think the topic we're going to be discussing today is very important. And the question we're asking today is wilderness still relevant? But before we jump in, and I'm sure we'll go in a bunch of different places, I'd like the audience to hear about you and your position, who you work for, all that good stuff. So let's why don't you take it away?
Well, my name is Eric Molvar, and I am the Executive Director of Western Watersheds Project, which is a nonprofit organization that works to protect and restore wildlife and watersheds throughout the American West. And we focus on livestock grazing and public lands. And then personally, my background is that I am a moose biologist by training, did my thesis research in Denali National Park in Alaska, and then went on to become a writer of wilderness guidebooks. And wrote, I think, 15 or 17 different guidebooks to wilderness areas, national parks, and other public lands in the American West and Alaska.
Okay, great. So when was your last guidebook published?
Well, my last guidebook for Falcon Publishing published in, I think, 2000. And that was Hiking Colorado's Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness in Colorado. But I've also done a number of books after that. I did a book called Wyoming's Red Desert, A Photographic Journey, which was kind of an all-star cast book of photography of the Red Desert and collection of essays. And then I also was the managing editor of the 50th Anniversary of Wilderness book that was put together by an interagency team of government entities.
Do you miss writing the guidebooks? Is that something you'd like to get into again someday?
Well, you know, I think my guidebook days are behind me now. You know, gone are the days when I could hike 1,200 or 1,400 miles in a summer and carry a 75-pound pack over 20 to 25 miles in a day, you know, scaling a couple different passes in a day. I really did grind my body pretty hard doing that, and covered more than 10,000 miles of hiking and backpacking, to the point where now I'm kind of a duffer. You know, I can get out and backpack a little bit these days, but I have nowhere near the stamina that I had in my 20s.
And what was your experience in some of these wilderness areas? What did you see out there, and what's sort of your takeaway now when you're looking back on all of your travels?
Well, there was tremendous diversity. I did guidebooks all the way from the Brooks Range in Alaska down to the Sonoran Desert in Arizona. So all manner of different habitats, lots of high mountain guidebook experiences, but also some desert canyon experiences. And almost all of my guidebook hiking was done solo. And so a lot of solitude. And sometimes I would go 2 and even 3 weeks without talking to another human being. And so I would get up in the morning, I would pack up my ruck and hike out across the trails and sometimes across the trailless regions. And I would take my notes as I went. And every afternoon I'd kind of write an account of what the trail had brought to me that day and interpret the geology and the biology and the scenery and which landmarks you would see along the way and the directions. And it was a really great experience. And, you know, one of the things that I took from that was a sort of uncanny sense of where I am in the world, because, you know, it was my job to not only know exactly where I was in areas that were poorly mapped and described. And, you know, so it became something where I would notice everything about where I was going, which direction I was going, what the landmarks were. And so it's become very difficult for me to get lost ever after.
And most of the places you were in were designated wilderness areas?
Well, it was a vast variety. You know, some of them were national parks that were not wilderness. Some of them were Forest Service areas that were non-wilderness. I would say more than half of the areas were designated official wilderness, capital W. And, you know, at least one area in the North Cascades, I believe I wrote the original book when it was not a wilderness. And then the Stephen Mather Wilderness was designated subsequently, and it became wilderness. And it actually didn't make any difference at all to how that park landscape and backcountry looked, felt, or was experienced. It was merely a change in designations.
Right. You see that in Yellowstone National Park. Actually, the backcountry areas there are not technically wilderness, but they're still managed to be wild. Like you have those grizzly bear management areas, for instance. So there's a strict set of standards. Would you say that the places that were designated wilderness that you visited, would they have looked the same if not for the Wilderness Act of 1964?
Well, it really depends, and probably not, given the rapacious nature of, you know, American commerce and the industries that we have out there. We have a timber industry that wants to get to every last stand of timber and log it. We have a mining industry that wants to find and exploit every single vein of mineral that they can possibly make a profit off of. We have an oil industry that wants to punch roads into every single place you can think of. I mean, there was a big fight in what is now the Grovant Wilderness in northwestern Wyoming. And in fact, that precipitated the wilderness designation, where one of the oil and gas corporations wanted to drive a road into those mountainous backcountry areas and turn that into what they hoped would be was a big oil and gas field. And the Wyoming residents kind of rose up and said no and went to their congressional delegation and said, hey, you guys got to do something about this. And out of that became the designation of the Grovant Wilderness. So, you know, I think over time, humanity will spread its tentacles to every far corner of the earth. And every single acre that becomes profitable to some industry or some individual is going to be exploited unless there's something there to stop it. And the Wilderness Act and its regulations provide a strong backstop to say that not everywhere should be wilderness or should be developed, that there should be some places that are affected primarily by the forces of nature. And I think that that's a really good statement for human society as we crest 8 million residents on the earth, which is probably more than the earth can sustain, that we need to leave some room for nature.
The Grovant Wilderness, I've been up there quite a few times, and I can't imagine it not existing today. Do you think the Grovant campaign could happen today in Wyoming in 2022, almost 2023?
Well, I think it could happen under the right circumstances. And, you know, I think you could get wilderness designations. Remember, the last Wyoming Wilderness Act was in the 1980s, and the representatives there were Dick Cheney, Malcolm Wallop, and Alan Simpson, all three Republicans, none of them particularly known as wilderness champions, and yet they set aside large tracts of wilderness. And what it requires in a state like Wyoming is for the locals to rise up and say, hey, look, these are areas that are special to us. We want you to set them aside. And we don't have to have every acre of Wyoming dedicated to oil and gas development, to coal mining, to clear cuts. Instead, we want to have some areas that that keep the landscape the way we always have enjoyed it in a more natural state. And Wyoming, of all the states, has the lowest population density, has some of the most intact ecosystems out there, and has the most to lose. And yet, at the same time, Wyoming society, from a cultural perspective, has a sort of frontier mentality where resources are limitless and we can gobble up all we want and there will always be more. And that's completely unrealistic, as anybody who lives east of the Mississippi can tell you, because they've lost their natural world out there in large measure, because everything has gone under the plow, under the axe, under the mining shovel.
And as the executive director of Western Watersheds Project, you get to oversee all of the activities happening across, was it 11 states or so in the West? What are you seeing more broadly as far as plundering of resources and the degradation of ecosystems? Like, what's happening out there right now?
Well, I think it's proceeding apace in much the same way as it always has in a lot of ways. Administrations come and go. They change between the Republicans and the Democrats. And yet there are always new strip mines and there are always new clear cuts and there are always new roads and new oil and gas fields. And there are livestock being permitted virtually everywhere without much regulation or limitation. And it is the custom and culture of the agencies that are supposed to be the stewards of our public lands and the wildlife that inhabit them to think that these are lands that should be managed for maximum dollar output, not maximum ecological sustainability. And that's a major mistake and a major shortcoming of these agencies and needs a major correction. Now, one of the things that we're seeing today under this particular administration, they're bent on solving the climate crisis. So they're clamping down on new oil and gas leasing, although certainly oil and gas drilling continues apace on all of the 10-year-long oil and gas leases that are already out there, which cover tens of millions of acres. And at the same time, they're wanting to ramp up renewables development on public lands, which is also a mistake because renewables are uniquely suited for siting in urban areas, particularly photovoltaic solar renewables, which could easily be accommodated on rooftops in urban areas, on parking lot shading structures, without converting any natural habitats into energy development sites. We don't have to do that. But what it takes is it takes a federal government with real policy vision to say, hey, look, let's do it right. And the way to do it right is not to build these renewable energy facilities thousands of miles away from the cities that they're going to serve, but instead put them up on the rooftops in the communities, give the solar panels to those communities at a sliding scale with maybe reduced prices for underserved communities so that they can become energy independent. And then lo and behold, not only do you not convert public lands to big solar farms or wind farms, but also you don't need giant transmission lines to take that energy to market.
So what happens to these landscapes when we have such unceasing development pressures? In this case, let's talk about solar installations, because these projects are tens of thousands of acres in size and they just gobble up these massive landscapes. What's at risk here? Does this preclude potential future wilderness designations or national parks or national monuments? What are the dangers going forward?
Well, you know, wilderness and natural areas in wild country generally is a landscape that's the remainder after subtraction. And everything that we've done on this continent since the first, you know, white colonialists set foot on these shores subtracts from the natural biodiversity and the natural ecosystems that were here when they arrived. So, you know, when you clear a forest, that takes out the naturalness. When you plow and plant a field, that takes out the naturalness. When you plat a town, that destroys that naturalness for a long period of time. Now, can these impacts come back? Well, sure, potentially, but it takes a lot of work. So, for instance, in New Jersey, there was one wilderness area that was designated and it had a paved county road running right through the middle of it. Congress said, we're going to designate this wilderness. They took up the paved road and kind of recontoured it, and today it is wilderness. There are other wilderness areas in the Appalachians that were heavily, heavily logged and badly damaged when the wilderness was designated. But over the span of decades, the trees grew back, and today you probably wouldn't know unless somebody told you that was once a clear cut or that was once a heavily fragmented forest. So nature can heal if you give it a chance. On the other hand, you know, with a growing population and growing demands for energy, for living space, for crop production, for all of the things that human society demands, it seems that, you know, the human footprint on the earth continues to spread and spread and spread and spread. And those wild landscapes and those natural ecosystems get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. I was formerly employed by Biodiversity Conservation Alliance. One of our board members was Mark Jenkins, who writes for Outside Magazine. And I remember attending a talk that he gave about the condition of wild places on other continents. And it was his assertion that if you go to Africa, these national parks, you know, they're full of an amazing diversity of wildlife, but they're tiny little postage stamps of wildlands in the midst of a sea of completely scorched earth development and destruction of the land. And so the Western United States, with its large expanses of relatively native ecosystems and getting less native all the time, of course, with the continued impacts of livestock and the introgression of invasive weeds that they bring like cheatgrass. But this is far different than what you find most of the rest of the world. And so this explains why when you go to a national park and you stop at the overlook, you're probably more likely to find that the person next to you is speaking a language you don't recognize, because they're coming to the United States to experience nature in a wild state because the place where they came from might not have it anymore.
How does Western Watersheds Project interface with wilderness? Does the organization get involved with wilderness management, designations, any and all the above?
Well, you know, Western Watersheds Project focuses primarily on the issue of livestock grazing. And there are a whole host of organizations that work primarily on wilderness designations. But Western Watersheds Project very commonly works together with wilderness organizations and coalitions. And particularly, we try to limit livestock grazing in wilderness areas and facilitate the buyout of grazing permits in wilderness. And we've done that in the Wind River, the Bridger Wilderness in the Wind River Range of Wyoming. There was a place when I wrote the book, Wild Wyoming, it was called by the agency folks the Sheep Desert, because there was a grazing permittee that ran tremendous numbers of sheep up into the alpine meadows and just destroyed it down to the bare dirt. And Western Watersheds Project Settlement Fund ended up buying out that Raid Lake allotment. And the Sheep Desert today is recovering, and that alpine tundra is coming back. In other cases, you know, we may assist behind the scenes in a lot of different ways with wilderness bills and wilderness legislation. For example, Western Watersheds Project quietly behind the scenes worked in Congress, having meetings with Senator Tester and Majority Leader Schumer to kill off a bill that Liz Cheney brought forward that was going to basically eliminate most of the Bureau of Land Management wilderness study areas in the state. And, you know, through the advocacy that I personally delivered to Washington, D.C., was able to kill off this bill and make it go away. And we're similarly working right now to fight behind the scenes against a Wyoming Public Lands Initiative bill, which all of the wilderness groups and public lands groups that are usually in the wilderness space in Wyoming also are fighting, which was a tremendously kind of unfair slicing and dicing of how the wilderness study areas would be managed in this state. And it was driven by, it was a collaborative process that was driven by the county commissions. And because the county commissions in Wyoming are largely anti-wilderness and pro-development, the answer that you got at the end of the day very much reflected that bias. And so that's not something that an outcome that reflects the public interest of the vast majority of Americans, because each American has an equal interest in federal public lands. It's not like the local community gets a special ownership of the public lands that surround them. Somebody from New York or Florida or California or Iowa has an equal stake in that acre of land as someone who lives 5 miles away.
At least they should have an equal say, but currently they do not, right? So fighting that is often an uphill battle and very frustrating, but the local folks don't care who are benefiting, right? They see it out their back windows, out their back ranches. They say, yeah, this is my land. So there were two major compromises to get the Wilderness Bill passed. Wilderness Act of 1964 took Howard Zonheiser 8 years and over 60 draft revisions. And there were two compromises. One was that mining could continue and new claims could not be entered after 1984. And the other one was grazing. Grazing could continue at or below current levels when the particular wilderness was designated. Grazing continues in wilderness today, and I'm sure many of the listeners have seen these impacts firsthand. But can you talk a bit about how the ranching industry might have been able to get such an exception into the Wilderness Act, and what implication that has had for these lands today?
Well, certainly the livestock industry has a very outsized influence politically compared to the number of the people who are engaged in ranching in the West, and indeed their economic output. In Wyoming, for instance, ranching is no more than, 1% of the gross domestic product of the state. And yet the legislature is stacked with ranchers. And, folks that want to run for Congress are always seeking the endorsement of the livestock interests. And this is how, this tiny little minority of people who really is economically inconsequential and really from a demographic perspective is kind of rounding error on state populations gets to kind of wag the dog. I mean, it's because county commissions are given such a big voice in public land decisions. And when you think about county commissions and who votes them in and who really votes in those elections, the folks who live in the towns tend to think, well, the county commissions, that's for those places outside the city limits. I'm going to focus on the city council race instead. And who's the mayor? Whereas the people out in the rural areas think, well, the county commission is going to dictate, the roads and the bridges and all these other things that facilitate my life. And so that is kind of seen as the province of the rural population. And the rural population is often maybe not dominated by the livestock industry in a kind of numbers or economic sense, but is dominated by the livestock industry in a social sense. The livestock industry sees itself as some kind of royalty, which is better than all the other residents, and therefore superior, and therefore should dictate how everybody else thinks. And I think the livestock industry has done a pretty crafty job of basically arguing that they speak for rural Western states, and that their opinions reflect the opinions of residents in these rural Western states. And that got a real test in 2020 when a ballot initiative was advanced to reintroduce wolves in Colorado. and the ag industry was confident that they were going to partner up with the trophy hunters from the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and basically prove to everybody who ran that state. And what happened was they lost. And it wasn't even all that close. You know, the livestock industry likes to say, oh, it was less than 1%, but it was close to 2% in a loss. And it wasn't all that close. And they lost counties in the West Slope of Colorado, which are considered kind of traditional rural Western counties. They lost to the people that wanted to have wolves come back to those mountains because Westerners have moved on. And the West is evolving. And the old West of cattle and barbed wire and mining and drilling is rapidly being replaced by a new West that's all about quality of life and amenities and tech industry. And this is the real engine of Western states these days. And, you know, the people that are drawn to that economy are not interested in seeing landscapes that are defiled and overgrazed and strip mined and drilled to death. They want to see spectacular mountains and wide open basins and abundant wildlife.
What's interesting is, and I've only heard this, I haven't actually checked, but the number one TV show in America right now is Kevin Costner's Yellowstone. So this idea of the cowboy is still very much alive in the American psyche in our culture. What does that say about us?
Well, the cowboy myth is, you know, somewhat seen as foundational to the United States. And in large measure, it's due to the fact that Hollywood was really obsessed with the Western during the 1940s and 1950s and early 1960s. And there were entire generations, and the baby boom generation grew up on Hollywood Westerns, on TV show Westerns. And it, you know, kind of portrayed this kind of mythology of the independence of the cowboy and you know, kind of the rugged individualism of the West, which couldn't have been any farther from the truth, of course, because, you know, none of these ranching operations have ever survived without a huge amount of community support locally and also federal subsidies that amount to huge piles of taxpayer dollars. So no ranching culture was ever, you know, kind of, you know, carved itself out of the wilderness and supported itself and stood up on its own two feet economically. No, these are industries that are entirely the result of, you know, federal subsidy programs that were initially designed to settle arid Western regions that were unpopulated so that state and federal governments could control those areas and, you know, and fight off other federal governments from Spain, from England, you know, from Russia and other countries that also had colonial ambitions. And of course, caught in the crossfire of all this were the indigenous people who lived here in the West and who did such a masterful job of living in harmony with nature compared to their successors of European extract.
So let's talk a bit about the wilderness idea. And also let's talk about the word wilderness and how it's tossed around. I just had an article published, and in the title, I said public lands because I was talking about public lands, but they went ahead and changed it to wilderness. You know, you see this everywhere. The word wilderness is just thrown around willy-nilly. And I think that's a bit of a problem because, you know, when we talk about wilderness, we're talking about areas that are, you know, free generally of human encroachment. And when I say humans, I'm talking about modern techno-industrial man, right? I think we really need to make that distinction because a lot of, you know, maybe you could call them postmodernists, I'm not sure, but there's a lot of attacks right now on wilderness and the wilderness idea. And there are a lot of good criticisms, and we'll talk about those here today. But maybe you could just talk a bit about the word wilderness and what it means and what you'd like people to be thinking about when you hear that word.
Well, when the first European colonizers showed up in North America, they saw basically the entire continent as wilderness. And when they said wilderness, you know, America is a howling wilderness, what they meant was it was primeval. It was primarily affected by nature. It was not dominated by human will. And they had come from a continent where the entire continent had been subjugated in terms of its natural ecosystems and bent to the will of the humans that occupied it. The forests had been deforested. The arable lands had been plowed. And they were in constant battle to try and, you know, fight over these resources that had then been turned to economic output. And they came to this continent and found on this continent what they saw as a vast, unoccupied, empty wilderness, which was in fact inhabited by complex and diverse, kind of array of indigenous tribal cultures. But they looked at this and said, well, wilderness is just whatever is beyond the pale of quote unquote civilization. And civilization was, defined as the farms and the towns that were settled and where you didn't have to worry so much about the bears and, kind of those, the natural forces of nature that then were seen very much as a threat. And that goes back to the European mythology of seeing nature as an enemy to be subjugated, but also as a fearful, fearsome, terrifying, terrorizing influence that had to be tamed. And then, of course, moving forward, as the North American continent was increasingly overrun by Euro-American settlement, the areas that still remained natural became less and less and less. And the great spectacles of nature, like the massive herds of bison, the great flocks of passenger pigeons, all of these things started to dwindle away. And you could only experience that natural wonder in a few remaining fragments that still remained relatively unspoiled by Euro-American settlement. And there became a growing voices of conservation, people like John Muir, people like Bob Marshall, saying that, hey, no, wilderness is not the enemy to be tamed. Wilderness is, an important asset to be stewarded and to be saved from being overrun by these economic forces. And so it really was the case that wilderness changed from something to be defeated to something to be treasured because of its relative scarcity. And it's almost like the law of supply and demand. The rarer it got, the more people appreciated it and wanted it and wanted to enjoy it. And the more social pressure there was for Congress to designate these capital W to wildernesses until, as you mentioned, in 1964, finally Congress passed the Wilderness Act. And the Wilderness Act put a formal legal term of art to wilderness and defined it in very, very specific ways. And if Congress had defined wilderness differently, we might be thinking of wilderness differently. But, what we think of as conservationists and environmentalists and to the knowledgeable members of the public who really understand and appreciate wilderness is that this is an area that is non-motorized and non-mechanized. This is an area where, kind of humans can visit but do not remain. That are affected primarily by the forces of nature. And that very much, those descriptions very much mirror the conditions across the vast majority of North America before Euro-American settlement and while it was occupied by indigenous peoples.
One of the arguments that people use who would rather not use the word wilderness, and, there are certainly good arguments to not use it, but when we're talking about the Wilderness Act and what that actually does on the landscape, I think it's important to not get those mixed up. The arguments you hear, and this is a common straw man argument, is that the idea of wilderness is devoid of any human influence over the centuries. Therefore, this idea of the wild doesn't actually exist. Can you respond to that?
Well, I think that that's kind of a fallacy. If you look at the way that humans were using the North American continent prior to the arrival of Lewis and Clark, say, in the West. For the most part, there were a few areas that indigenous groups were cultivating and farming, but the vast majority of the landscape was used for hunting and gathering subsistence, which meant that they were living in portable lodges that could be folded up and moved. They were following abundances of resources seasonally across the landscape. They might have left behind trails and camp spots, much like you'll find today in wilderness areas. But they were visitors who didn't remain in some ways of looking at it. Sure, their cultures were integral to those landscapes, and they lived and inhabited those landscapes, but they lived and inhabited those landscapes without the kind of industrial, heavy-handed human domination of nature. They instead coexisted with the natural world as one type of species amongst many type of species in a way that was much more humble and less domineering than the Euro-American settlers that came afterwards and replaced them in many places. And, of course, indigenous people are still here in North America. You know, they're not just on reservations. They're part of our culture. They're in urban areas. They visit wilderness too. And if you look at the wilderness that we do have that are formally designated by Congress, you're going to find networks of trails, much like you would have found networks of trails from human movements and habitation before the times of Lewis and Clark. You're going to find hardened camp spots, much like you might have found those types of impacts. So, you know, kind of the you will also find domestic livestock, which is a level of human impact far greater than anything you would have found during the indigenous period in North America. And so in many ways, I think the human imprint on wilderness today is potentially greater than it would have been under a subsistence hunting and gathering indigenous culture rubric.
Another refrain you hear often is that wilderness is just a product of Western civilization. Can you respond to that?
Well, wilderness is a product of Western civilization, much like every other land use is a product of Western civilization. And so, you know, I've seen it said that, you know, we shouldn't use wilderness because wilderness was really born out of the displacement of indigenous people and the depopulation of formerly populated areas. I don't think that's accurate. Frankly, the Wilderness Act, wasn't passed until 1964. By, you know, the areas, the cultural genocide and the ethnic cleansing that happened to the indigenous peoples, moving them to reservations, had been completed decades before that, you know, the first wilderness was ever designated, even before Aldo Leopold and his first administratively designated wilderness in the Gila in the 1920s. That era had already closed. And so, I mean, to say that wilderness should be a dirty word because, you know, it is part of the displacement of indigenous peoples carries about as much weight as saying you shouldn't say cities, because every place that was a city, there were indigenous cultures that were displaced. Every place there was farmland, there were indigenous cultures that were displaced. Every place that there is a ranch, there were indigenous cultures that were displaced. Every land use we have in modern North America exists on an acre that was formerly inhabited by indigenous tribes, and those indigenous tribes were displaced prior to that land use coming to pass. I think we need to look at and recognize the displacement of indigenous peoples from these landscapes. We need to think about, you know, how the wrongs of those previous generations can be reconciled in this generation. And the first step is going to be to stop making things worse for these groups, obviously. But then we need to move forward from that point also and think about, you know, how we can be more inclusive of their interests and honor more both their custom and culture and their ties to the land. And I think that that's something that is a growing trend right now in land management. And I think it's by and large a beneficial one.
So Native American occupation was omitted from the Wilderness Act, and that's very painful to a lot of, or if not most or all, indigenous and Native American folks today. So how do we grapple with this and still keep wilderness relevant, and how do you communicate that, if that is the case?
Well, that's a really, really difficult question. And as, you know, kind of as a white person, I feel almost unqualified to answer the question, because I think the first thing that we have to do is start having conversations with indigenous people who are focused on these same issues. And, you know, frankly, we're starting to have those conversations and as conservation professionals today, and we're starting to see places like Bears Ears where tribal co-management is coming into public lands management in ways that I think are going to be beneficial. And I think that there are, you know, kind of places where tribal, you know, traditional ecological knowledge is being incorporated. And there was recently a secretarial order that formally kind of called that forth and said, we're going to pay more attention to traditional ecological knowledge. And why wouldn't we? Because, you know, the tribes know things and the traditional cultures knew things about the land, about the wildlife, about the pattern of land use of different species, where different species of plants could be found, that frankly, Western science hasn't been all that interested to find out. And so they have information we don't have that can help inform our land management and make it better and more robust and make it more ecologically sustainable. And I think it's going to help strengthen conservation efforts.
Do you think wilderness designation is still relevant? Is it still important to have new wilderness designations and to continue the existing system of wilderness going forward?
I think it's absolutely essential to do this because wilderness is one of those few designations that has real legal teeth that fundamentally stops industrial uses of wild country. And very little else is out there that can really say, we're going to put a stop to industrial commercial exploitation, at least most kinds of it, maybe not livestock production in all cases, but on public lands. And, you know, the great ecologist E.O. Wilson put it best and said that nature needs half. We need to set aside half of the earth for the native species of the earth that are non-human. If they're going to survive. And he predicted if we did set aside half the earth, we could save 85% of the species that we have today. That still means that 15% of the species that inhabit the earth today are likely to go extinct under his estimates, even if we save half the earth and only have human domination on half of it. I think we need to scale back. I think we need to protect large areas of intact ecosystems wherever we can. Wilderness is a great tool to do that. There are many other tools to do that. And there are calls to undertake rewilding in the West. And recently, there was an excellent scientific article that was published and that proposed that we start rewilding the West by bringing back wolves and bringing back beavers, and identified large core areas and connectivity regions that would help us do that. And I think wilderness has a role in that overall conservation package. I think there are other designations that also could play a role, but fundamentally, at the bottom, what needs to happen is in these areas, whether it's the 30 by 30 initiative that the Biden administration is trumpeting and saying, we're going to protect 30% of America by 2030, those need to be natural areas. Those need to be areas with healthy native ecosystems. We can't just set aside open space and it's, say, a cornfield that's a monoculture of a non-native species that's ecologically a desert and say, hey, look, we've saved this. This is going to contribute towards our 30 by 30. That's not happening. We need native ecosystems in order to bring back the biodiversity, because the loss of biodiversity on this planet is one of the most fundamental crises that humanity faces. And even if we don't have the generosity and humility and wisdom to save nature for its own sake, because other species have value, because healthy ecosystems have value, then let's do it, because if we continue to wipe out all the other species, we'll go extinct right along with them. It's in our self-interest.
In these lands outside of wilderness designation that we might be looking to better protect, we see the wholesale destruction of ecosystems happening here, right? And you touched on this earlier. We see massive logging. We see intensive grazing. We see roading. We see, you know, all sorts of activities. What sorts of new land designations or how can we change management to actually ensure that these areas outside of wilderness get the protection that would be needed in order to meet the criteria of a 30 by 30 or a half earth, et cetera?
Well, certainly, you know, the first thing you want to do is you want to have large core areas that might be wildernesses or national parks or national wildlife refuges, and then manage those areas for primarily for the through for natural processes and for native species. And in significant measure, we do that, but sometimes we don't. So some of our national wildlife refuges are heavily overrun by livestock, and in some cases even dedicated to cultivation of farms and fields and irrigation, which is completely inappropriate for a national wildlife refuge. But we do it because the national wildlife refuge system has some real fundamental problems. And then in those areas that are multiple use landscapes, landscapes that by law are supposed to have multiple uses, and by law, the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management are both multiple use agencies, each of which has hundreds of millions of acres of public land under its jurisdiction. They must, you know, provide timber mining and livestock somewhere on those lands, but not every use on every acre. But they must also provide for wildlife, for wilderness, for public recreation. These are also multiple uses guaranteed in law. And we need to shift that balance so that we have the extractive and commercial uses happening only in places and at levels that can be sustained by fully intact and restored healthy native ecosystems. If your timber operation fundamentally destroys the forest ecosystem, you're doing it wrong and you should be doing it differently. If your grazing scheme takes out so much of the forage that it is degrading the native vegetation species and decimating native populations of herbivores and causing invasive species to come in and fueling fires and such things as we have today, then your grazing needs to change. If your mining is happening everywhere so that there is no landscape that you can stand and look and enjoy a natural vista without seeing a mountaintop removal or a big open pit somewhere, then we need to change how much mining we allow. The degree to which we allow these commercial uses is completely out of control, because the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management fundamentally and from their beginning have a culture of exploitation of the land, not stewardship for the land. And that needs to change. And so once we step outward from the protected areas, which are seen as primarily for conservation, toward those areas that are for more multiple use, we need to shift that multiple use. And we also need to connect these core areas that are protected together so that the wildlife can move between them, both in migrations from season to season, but also in dispersal. Because as climate change progresses, and it is progressing now, vegetation patterns are going to shift. You're going to see vegetation that used to be at the valley bottoms moving up in elevation to find that kind of climate that it's adapted to. You're going to have species and ecosystems potentially moving northward. Already you see the climate of Denver is like what Albuquerque used to be 20 years ago. Maybe Salt Lake City is becoming the next Phoenix, and Phoenix is becoming the next Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, in terms of its climate. I mean, these changes are massive, and it's going to involve a kind of a region-wide shift in ecosystem distribution. And we need to have these protected areas connected so as the ecosystem shift, those wildlife that are dependent on those ecosystems can shift with their habitats and colonize new areas and survive. Because otherwise, you know, if all the juniper woodlands suddenly are found in interior British Columbia and they're no longer in the West, and the juniper obligate birds and mammals are unable to move with them, they'll go extinct and we'll lose that biodiversity.
So industry has such a tight grip, as you mentioned, on our federal land management agencies. And we see a lot of what's called collaborative conservation happening today, which is supposed to get us out of this biodiversity pickle that we're in right now. What is collaborative conservation, and do you see that as being the solution to getting us out of this predicament and on a new path?
Well, collaboration and collaborative conservation, you know, it sounds good to everybody, but it's really just a fad, and it's a fad that's designed to be a new way for the extractive industries to dominate public land management as they always have. And what happened was in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, the American public grew in power and conservation organizations grew in strength and started to threaten the death grip that the oil industry, the livestock industry, the mining industry, the logging industry had on Western public lands. And these industries needed to find a way to cut off the power base of conservation because the vast majority of the American public wanted more conservation and less industrial destruction. And so what they did was they invented this cute little collaborative idea. And the idea was, well, we'll have our politicians, which are usually in our pocket, nominate people to these collaborative groups. And we'll have two representatives from conservation and two from livestock industry and two from the mining industry and two from the timber industry and two from the county commissioners and two from the state legislators. And so we'll stack the deck so that the 80% of Americans that are for more conservation and less industrial use will be about 10% of these collaborative groups, and 90% of the collaborative groups will be our industries and our allies, and we will snuff out conservation change because all we have to do is say we're going to veto any conservation change. We can dig in and entrench our business as usual approach. And that's the biggest problem with collaborative conservation that people don't recognize is that when these collaborations are convened and the rules are that everybody has to agree or nothing moves forward, that what that means is that anybody has veto power. Anybody can say no. And if what you need is change and doing something different, then one person with veto power can stop that change. But if what you want is to keep things the same and keep that privileged space that you have, that use of the land, that abuse of the land, and prevent anybody from changing that, all you need is one vote on that collaborative group to block consensus. And so conservation groups have very foolishly been kind of snookered into this collaborative conservation model because, you know, of the public optics of it, the idea that, oh, everybody comes to the table, we all talk together politely, we learn about each other, we learn to respect each other, and we compromise, and in the end, we can find something we can all agree on. But when you take the Venn diagram of all the universe of possible pro-conservation outcomes and the universe of all of the outcomes that are industrially profitable, the overlap from those two interests is so tiny and so irrelevant to conservation that it's not even worth pursuing. I want to say that again. The union between what advances conservation and what advances industrial use is so minuscule that it doesn't do anything for conservation. Therefore, it's not worth pursuing.
So collaborative conservation now is, it's everywhere. It's driving land management, and these proposals get brought to senators and reps in Congress, and they say, see, we've worked it all out, so you don't have to jump in the sandbox and get all messy with us. We've already fought it over, and we've got this beautiful thing, and you can just, you know, you can pass it, and you've got the support of everybody. I see collaborative conservation as being the number one threat going forward to seeing the sort of changes that enviros would actually like to see happen out there. How do we get through and move past collaborative conservation into a new paradigm, into a new era? What is that going to take? Do we need courage? Where does that come from? And, you know, how do we get conservation groups to actually acknowledge this problem?
Well, the first step is to recognize collaboration for the Trojan horse that it really is. And it really is an industrial anti-environmental agenda that is being, you know, kind of forced on conservation groups and is trying to hijack them. And recognizing that that you're about to be hijacked and that this is a con job that you want no part of is really the first stage in starting to combat it. And then, of course, the second stage is to go back and fundamentally ask yourself, what has worked to advance conservation in the United States? If you think of all the great conservation victories that have ever happened over the last century, the wilderness designation, the national parks designation, the saving of the bald eagle, the saving of the peregrine falcon, the wolf recolonizing parts of the West, all of these great conservation victories came as a result of strong advocacy from conservation groups, strong advocacy by the American public, and strong laws from Congress that were then held by the conservation groups holding the agency's feet to the fire and suing them. This is what works. The number of great conservation victories that have come out of collaboration can be counted on no hands because there aren't any. And the sooner that conservationists can recognize this, that this is a losing proposition that merely puts a fresh gloss of wrapping paper over the same old box of business as usual, the sooner they can recognize that what they are actually doing is enabling the very industries that they should be trying to regulate and limit.
Okay. And yeah, we're seeing a lot of collaboration going on in the wilderness sphere right now, too, particularly right now in Montana. We're seeing it in Oregon as well. I mean, every state has it. It's a bit of a mess. But thanks for your thoughts on that, Eric. I appreciate it. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to speak on?
Well, you know, I think one of the big overarching issues that we have in American culture is that, you know, our modern culture that came out of its Euro-American roots and through kind of American imperialism that happened worldwide is that nature is something that needs to be dominated and needs to be managed in order to have healthy lands or, you know, a good outcome for our communities. And in fact, one of the things that we need to recognize as humans is that natural processes are bigger than us. Nature bats last. And sometimes when we do, you know, things to manage nature and we do it poorly, we end up making things worse for ourselves. And indeed, there's a lot of wisdom in respecting the natural processes and trying to restore the natural processes to the way they always function. Because one of the things in the arid West that we have done with our cattle, with our irrigation, with the various land uses that we have, including deforestation, is that we've desertified much of the West. If you look at the journals of the early European explorers in the American West, they talk about grass being up to the bellies of their horses. They talk about these lush, you know, kind of rich game populations. And, you know, you had 380,000 wolves roaming the western United States and Mexico, based on the science, prior to Lewis and Clark. You had 10 million elk. Today, we only have 1 million, even with our vaunted North American model and all those wildlife management agencies focusing most of the game and fish dollars on elk and other game species. We only have one-tenth of the elk that we once had. We have, a few hundred thousand bison, perhaps, where once there were 60 million of them. We have such an impoverished landscape that's out there from a natural perspective. And what we should be doing is figuring out how to have not a predatory or parasitic relationship with nature, where we profit and nature is harmed, but to have a mutualistic relationship with nature, where we benefit and nature benefits, and we are able to manage our own activities and allow nature to manage its own activities to a greater extent so that we can have landscapes that are healthy from an ecological standpoint and, frankly, are richer, more beautiful, and better for our own qualities of life.
Okay. Well, this was a great chat. I appreciate you taking some time this evening. Yeah, I guess we'll leave it there. Again, I'll leave it open if you have anything else. If not, we'll part ways.
Well, thank you very much, Adam, for having me on your show, and I really appreciate it. And it's great to have an opportunity to share some thoughts on conservation with you.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Take care.
You too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com.